Okay, you're on. Okay, thank you, everybody. I personally don't mind a hiss unless it comes from the audience, so that's perfectly fine. We are still continuing with a very, very fascinating story. It's a long story, and Rav Kook has many, many beautiful and interesting ideas that he offers in the story. And if you recall, we're up to the point at which a decision was made to replace Ravin Gamliel. But the problem is, who do you replace him with? And the final compromise in politics, we would call him a dark horse candidate, was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, number one, was wealthy, and therefore he would be able to be politically savvy in terms of negotiating with the Romans. Wealth was not something... Well, actually, let me think about that a little bit more. I was going to say that wealth was not necessarily an important characteristic vis-a-vis the spiritual leadership of the Nasi, but it would be important in terms of the political leadership. On the other hand, wealth also has a certain component in spirituality. There are other statements in the Gemara that actually indicate that a rav or a judge should try to be economically independent, because that way people cannot dictate his decision. So be it as it may, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was wealthy, and number two, he had great yichus, he had lineage, because his lineage went all the way back to Ezra, going back 10 generations, and just as Ezra reconstituted the Jewish community and the aftermath of the destruction of the first temple, so too Elazar ben Azariah could do so in the aftermath of the destruction of the second temple. He would be a person who could unify, bring people together, create a spirit of spiritual revival. Again, I've said this many, many times. Remember that this is the aftermath of the Korban. This is in Yavne, in which the Jewish people have been devastated, demoralized. So many great and righteous people have been murdered. And as a result, we need a leader that can bring people together. Remember, Rabban Gamliel's shita was, you bring people together by a certain autocratic dictatorship. That's what he felt was needed. They're disagreeing with that, but you still need a leader that will bring people together. Problem is, amazingly enough, Rav Elazar ben Azariah, although he is ordained, he is called Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, is only 18 years old. He goes to his wife. I guess he did get married young, or as Chazal say, get married at the age of 18. She initially says, hey, this is a very difficult crowd. And they fire Rabban Gamliel. What if they fire you? And his response was, even if you only have a limited opportunity to use a precious goblet of glass and it's going to break, use it for the moment that you can use it. And if you recall, I think the last thing I told you was Rav Kook's thoughts, that this is the opposite of arrogance. If you take a position for kavod, your concern is, how long will I have the job? I'm not going to take the kavod if I'm going to get humiliated. But if you take the position because of the good that you're able to accomplish, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's argument is, if I'm only going to be a nasi for 24 hours, I'll do what I can for those 24 hours. If I get humiliated, it makes no difference, because I'm not taking the job for me. I'm taking the job for what I can do for Hashem, and whatever Hashem gives me, whatever time he gives me, I'm going to use in a good way. In fact, there's an old legend. Again, Rabbi Wein can certainly tell you more about it than I don't remember all the details, about a, may in fact be historically true, about a Jewish fellow who wound up to be king of Poland for just one day. In that one day, there was somehow some type of legal convolution that made him king just for that 24-hour period. And in those 24 hours, he did quite a lot of good. Imagine if you would be president for a day, prime minister for a day. Well, okay. Well, you might be able to do a better job than the president. Well, okay. That's not true. Okay. In the Beit Knesset HaNasi, I should not say anything about anti-politics. Okay. Anyway, so the second thing his wife raised was, you're so young. You're 18 years old. An 18-year-old man is going to be the Nasi of the Sanhedrin? And a miracle happens. And his beard turned white. And he looked old. And this is the meaning of the very well-known passage that we recite every Pesach Seder. Hare ani keven shivim shana. I am like a person who is 70 years old. And the Talmud explains he was not 70, he just looked like he was 70 years old. The pashtus of the Gemara was this was a supernatural miracle. People respected even the appearance of age. He looked venerable. Some commentaries want to suggest that maybe there was also a derech hateva, that the sudden responsibility of taking the position turned his hair white. And this can actually happen. This can actually happen. Sometimes the shock of a position. They say, for example, I remember that Barbara Bush, George Bush Sr.'s wife, her hair turned prematurely gray when their daughter had leukemia. Back in the 1960s, just happened all of a sudden. My wife likes to remind me that our friends who did not go into Rabbanus, who are the same age, still have black hair, and those who gravitated to Rabbanus tend to have gray hair. So you know there is some truth in that as well. But Rav Kook makes another point. On one hand, let's go with the miracle, because that's the pashtus of the Gemara. The pashtus of the Gemara was this was a supernatural miracle, that Hashem wanted him to be respected. But Rav Kook says there's another side to this as well, and this goes back to the fundamental dispute regarding what type of leadership do you need. Rabbi Gamliel felt, in order to unify the Jewish people, and again, Rav Kook is very emphatic, this is not about ego or gaiva, and again, we'll see some proofs for this, but this is Rabbi Gamliel feels that at a time when we are trying to recover from crisis, there needs to be a leader. There cannot be so many different people moving in different directions, because then you don't have Achdus, and that is why he does not brook any opposition. But the position of the Talmidim that are replacing him say, it's the other way around. Your job as Nasi is not to be the boss. Your job as Nasi is to create an atmosphere where every Talmid Chacham is respected. And in that way, that creates an Avir, where each person will gravitate to a Rav or a Talmud Chacham, because they see from the very top that these are the respected, important people. So the siman min hashamayim, that this is correct, is a white beard. Weiser of Cook points out that you often find that the image of the zaken with a white beard is a symbol of rachamim. For example, there's a medrash that says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Am Yisrael in different types of images. Although Hashem, of course, does not have an image, but sometimes our mind processes what Hashem is doing and turns it into a picture. By Kriyas Yamsuf, Hashem was Ish Milchama, this parsha, a man of war. At Matan Torah, he was Zaken Malei Rachamim, an old man who has seen so much of life and looks at people with compassion and understanding. So what Hashem is doing is the following. Rabbi Gamliel maintains Nasi has to be strong and even autocratic. But Hashem takes the new Nasi and says, I'm going to make you old, because what you should be as a Nasi is the Zaken Malei Rachamim. Malei Rachamim. And therefore, in a sense, Rav Kook says, this is a heavenly validation of the very position that is being taken by replacing Rabbi Gamliel as the Nasi. That Hashem wants a Zakei Molei Rachamim, so people will be inspired by love and genuine respect. And they will gravitate to the Torah not because they're forced to do so. They will gravitate to the Torah because they will see it as something that is beautiful and noble. And of course, what can I tell you? In a way, every commentator is explaining based on the quality of their soul that comes through. But this is obviously a biographical or autobiographical comment of how Rav Kook himself perceived his role as a manhig Yisrael, not a manhig that tells people what they have to do, but a manhig who inspires by the example of who he is, in which you want to do like him because you want to be like him. And Rav Kook is saying that that's exactly the narrative of what the white beard shows. Now, I myself have a little kasha on Rav Kook, because Rav Kook says here, although it's kasha on the Medrash really, Rav Kook says, the Zaken Mole Rachamim, or the Zaken, is a symbol of Mole Rachamim. But I can give you a Gemara that actually says the opposite. The Gemara talks about a mandatory retirement. Rav Elazar ben Azariah's problem was he was too young. But there actually is a rule that when a Dayan and the Sanhedrin reached a certain age, he had to retire. And the reason is because he had forgotten what it was like to raise young children. And therefore there might be a streak of cruelty there, because he'd forgotten what it was like, you know, to take care of the young and the helpless. So I'm not sure exactly. It's a little bit of a contradiction. Sometimes the Gemara indicates that as a person gets older, they get a little less tolerant because they're no longer involved in the day-to-day. You know, even grandparents, you know, we sometimes love our grandchildren, but not too long. You know, if they want to come over for a week or so, you know, maybe it's a little too much at some point. But that's a secret. Don't okay. All right. Yeah.
What's the age of mandatory requirement?
You know, I honestly don't know. It's interesting that La Halacha, it's not quantified in any particular way. But I think the Hanhaga was 80. Now, obviously, let me point out, this is not a disqualification of a posek, right? A posek, you know, continues to answer Shilas as long as they are able. But the official position of the Sanhedrin, which we don't have today anyway. Now, there is a mandatory retirement even in Eretz Yisrael, in the Beit, not just for secular judges, but even the Beit Din HaGadol has a mandatory retirement. I even believe for Rav HaRashi, isn't that so? I think there was a whole... I don't know how old... David Lau is young, how old Rav Yitzchak Yosef is. But I think 70 was a mandatory. In fact, they wanted to change it when Rav Ariel was a candidate. He was approaching his 70th birthday. He wanted to change the law, as it were. But I believe that the position, you can't take the position when you're 70.
Stern was supposed to be the Rav Rashi in Yerushalayim.
Yes.
A few days before his 70th birthday, he was elected.
That's correct.
Had they postponed it, he would not have been able to...
Oh, that's right. But he is the referee. He is the referee, right?
But if they had postponed the day,
that's what you call a grandfather clause. If you get in a day before your birthday,
you're okay. 10 years.
Okay, I'm say that. But at least you can't assume the position at the age of 70. At the age of 70. Yeah.
I understand that they wanted to change the maximum age.
Yeah.
So that Rabbi Amar could run again.
Oh, Rabbi Amar, okay.
But then what would happen is it would have opened the door to Rabbi Lau Sr. to run again.
Oh, would he be interested?
That's
interesting.
Since
okay.
He didn't want to open that door.
Okay, all right. Well, that's interesting Israeli politics. Rav Lau Sr., Baruch Hashem, could get any position he wanted, including President of Israel, if he actually wanted it. So, Baruch Hashem. Okay. Alrighty. So, Rav Elazar ben Azariah now becomes old, or he looks old, and the like. That's Harei Ani Kiven Shivim Shana. And now we go on with what happened afterwards. Now there was another policy change. So first of all, you have a different leadership style. But now we read a different change, a major change that was made. Remember that the whole Gemara is not entirely clear. What exact position are we talking about? Are we talking about head of yeshiva? Are we talking about head of Sanhedrin? Are we talking about chief justice or chief Rosh Yeshiva? Are we talking about both positions? The Gemara seems to go back and forth as to what the exact position is, but now we're going to focus on the yeshiva aspect. And there was somebody called Shomer HaPetach, gatekeeper. People who wanted to be admitted to this advanced yeshiva, you had to take certain admission tests, and it was not just a matter of Torah knowledge, but Rabban Gamliel had a very limited policy of admission. And the rule was, anyone that is not Tocho Kibaro Al Yikanes. Tocho is your inside, Baro is your exterior. Now, I'm not sure how they tested this exactly, but Tocho Kibaro means you're the same on the inside as you are on the outside. outside you can look from religious, but if in inside your midot are not good, or in the inside you don't have real Yiras Shamayim, the fact that externally you may behave in a proper way, that was not enough. Now again, I'm not sure, and the Gemara doesn't tell us exactly, how do you test for that particular quality? We do have different stories. I mean, just to give you a little example, the Chassam Sofer used to once noticed two boys after Sukkot, when there was a lot of sechach on the ground, like you have it here in Eretz Yisrael, right? The ground is filled with thrown away sechach. And one boy just walked over the sechach, and another boy circled around it. And the Chassam Sofer said, that's real Yiras Shamayim. That even though, halachically, by the way, you can walk on the sechach, it's not forbidden, but your instincts are so honed, right? That type of thing. But whatever it was, Rabban Gamliel's yeshiva was relatively small, because he basically had a very rigorous standard. You can't go in unless you are as righteous inside as outside. Meaning, now you may say, well, wait a second. If you're not so good inside, how are you going to become better if you're not given Torah education? Well, Rabban Gamliel said, this is a yeshiva for leaders. This is not a cheder. This is not a yeshiva for beginners. This is a yeshiva for those who are going to become the leaders of Am Yisrael. You want to go to leadership school? You have to first develop your character with midot
tovot. Rabbi Wein says that was almost universally true of all the yeshivas in Europe.
That what? That you had to be Toho Kibara?
Yeah, they were leadership schools.
Yes. So that actually is true. The whole role of yeshivos today is very, very different than it was in Europe. Although in Europe, we like to talk about Europe as the golden years. And of course, it was very golden in the sense of so many Jews were Shomer Mitzvot. But one has to remember, number one, certainly by the mid-19th century and downwards, there was a precipitous decline, even in Eastern Europe, in observance because of Haskalah and communism and socialism and political Zionism and many, many movements, the reform movement, of course, that was spreading as well. But still, the overall observance of mitzvot was much higher than we have in most of the world today. But the role of yeshivas were very, very different. Yeshivas were elitist institutions. They were very selective. There was no concept that the average boy went to yeshiva. The average boy went to work at 15. The average girl didn't do anything, any type of chinuch until Beis Yaakov in the 1920s. But the average boy, went to work at 15, and assuming he was not subject to Haskalah or the other forces, he was a Yiras Shamayim, he davened every day, he would learn Chumash or go to an Ein Yaakov shir, I mentioned the Ein Yaakov Jew, and was a Yiras Shamayim, and Baruch Hashem, that was a major, major backbone of Am Yisrael. But the yeshivas were for the geniuses, the yeshivas were for the leaders, the yeshivas were for the elite. They were the equivalent, lahavdil, of MIT and Harvard and Stanford and Caltech. In fact, I'll tell you an interesting thing. I once had to go to a Beis Din in Bnei Brak.
What I'm saying is, how is that any different from the approach?
Yeah, I'll get to it. I digress a lot, but I will circle back to the point. I went to a Beis Din in Bnei Brak. And I was representing as an attorney, a rabbinic attorney for a certain side. And the other side also had an attorney who was actually a woman, interestingly enough, in Bnei Brak based in. And she was representing the other side. And, we went to different law schools. She went to one law school, I went to another law school. So the Dayanim didn't know what the difference was. They didn't understand, what's this law school, what's that law school, etc. So one Dayan was American. He said, like Mir Panovitz. Oh, Mir Panovitz, now we understand. Etc. So the yeshivas were very elitist institutions. And in fact, that is why the Derech HaLimud of yeshiva was so advanced, so much in depth, all the commentaries. One of the mistakes, again, it's a mistake, one could argue about this, is we've now created a system. Again, perhaps it's necessary, in which yeshiva is the standard education for every Orthodox person. Every Orthodox boy goes to yeshiva for a certain amount of time. And yet the problem is the curriculum that we have in our yeshiva was based on a model that made much more sense when the yeshivas were geared to Eloyim and geniuses. It's as if to say every single boy must enter a PhD program in nuclear physics. That was appropriate when the schools were training nuclear physicists. They were not necessarily appropriate if you're training Balabatim. And that is why one of the great issues people were facing in education is, well, do we keep the yeshiva program as is? Or do we emphasize more chumash, more halakha, more things that other than the in-depth learning of Gemara that actually confuses a lot of people? Now, the issue that you raised about yeshivas being elite, I think is somewhat different than Rabbi Gamliel's position. The yeshivas were elitist institutions because they were focusing on how smart you were, primarily. It was not at all a test of midot tovot, and in fact, until Rabbi Saul Salanter's Musar movement, one of the big problems in a yeshiva like Volozhin is that many of the Talmidim were brilliant geniuses who were either arrogant or freethinkers. So Volozhin was not concerned. Volozhin was a great yeshiva. And Volozhin produced many, many, many gedolim, of course. But the Brisker Rav himself, who was the son of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who together with the Netziv was the last Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. The Brisker Rav said that although it was a tragedy that the Volozhin Yeshiva closed down in the 1890s, he says it was min hashamayim, because Volozhin, in its great emphasis on how smart you were, is introducing, you know, people who didn't have the midos, etc., and therefore we needed a different type of yeshiva which emphasized musar and character. But we'll come back to this. So Rabban Gamliel's position was you have to be tocho kibora, and therefore he was very, very selective in who gets admitted. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria removed open admissions. Open admissions. Whoever wants to come and learn, come and learn. Now, the Gemara says, he admits that if it's clear that somebody has bad midot, then for an advanced yeshiva like this, he should not be admitted. In other words, it is clear that he admits in principle that a person who, even if he's bright and smart and brilliant, if it's clear that he does not have good midot, we don't admit him. But in cases of doubt, we don't have to know. We can assume from his behavior that he is okay. And the Gemara tells us, the Gemara quotes the following statement. This is a very famous statement. Le'olam yaso adam b'torah v'mitzvos afilu shelo lishma. It is proper for a person to learn the Torah and do mitzvos, even if their motives are not pure. Shemitoch shelo lishma. By doing the Torah and the mitzvos, even for ulterior motives, you eventually purify your character. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria's point was, instead of saying, we're not going to take you until you have purity of character, as long as externally you're following the rules, we'll take you with the hope and the expectation that the Torah will purify your character, that the learning of there will purify your character. Now again, well, let's go, let me finish a little bit of the story, and then I want to go back over this. In other words, Rabban Gamliel says, we're not going to teach a person advanced Torah unless he comes in with a good character. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria's position is, the shelo lishma will bring the person to lishma. And it mentions that that very day, because of the open admissions policy, there were 400 benches. I don't know how many people sat on a bench. We're not really told that. But 400 benches had to be added to the Beis HaMedrash. Now, I'm not sure how big the Beis HaMedrash was, unless they had a big Beis HaMedrash, and under Rabban Gamliel, only a tiny part of it was filled. And then it expanded. So many people wanted to learn Torah. So many people were eager and anxious to learn Torah. Rabban Gamliel now sees all of the people who had been turned away because of his policy. And Rabban Gamliel now has chalisha sadas. He now has sadness and despair. Do you mean that I was responsible for all of these people not learning? maybe I was wrong. How could I behave this way? But Hashem gave him a dream. And the dream that he had was, he dreamt of beautiful, big, white jars. Imagine like big flower pots, ceramic, white flower pots. They're beautiful and they're clean, but they were filled with ashes. And the dream was, yeah, all of these great people are in the Beis HaMedrash. They look so good, they look so devoted. They're filled with ashes. So when Gamliel gets a dream, that seems to say he's right. But the Gemara then comments years later, but you know, that wasn't the case. God just wanted him to feel good. Now, it's either God wanted him to feel good or he wanted to feel good. It's not clear the source of that dream. Which means, the Gemara seems to indicate that indeed the open admissions policy was in fact preferable. Because instead of saying, you can't learn Torah till you're a good person, we actually say Torah will make you a good person. Now, Rav Kook points out, there's a special imagery with ashes. Because there's why ashes instead of dirt? In fact, in a flower pot, you would expect there to be dirt. Why ashes? So he says the following. This is part of what, of the, at least the fake reassurance Rabbi Gamliel is being given. Unlike dirt, when you mix dirt with water, the dirt kind of unifies with the water and it clumps. When you mix ashes with water, right, ashes don't dissolve, they don't clump. So here's the argument. Torah is compared to water. So it was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's position. Mix the water with the dirt, and the water unifies with the dirt, and it becomes one entity called mud, but it's one entity. The Torah will change you. Rabbi Gamliel says, no, no. People with bad midot are like ashes. You can pour all the water on them that you want, but they never really unify. But ashes don't absorb water in that way. That's the image of the ashes. But, the Gemara says, Rabbi Gamliel was not correct. Indeed, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was correct. Now, what's interesting...
The Torah conformed to the clean which it was poured into. So if it was a guy with bad needles, it would amplify the bad needles.
Right. Yeah, actually, I wanted to share that very thought. Everybody knows, in fact, we just learned at this moment as well, the idea that Torah is compared to water. Everybody knows that. And there are a lot of reasons. Water goes from high ground to low ground. Water is necessary for life. Water purifies. Water cleans. Water nourishes. Right? So Torah is water. But de Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to Mishlei, says a striking, striking idea, exactly what you said. De Vilna Gaon says, the nature of water is, whatever you pour it on is caused to grow. Water is medium neutral. If I pour water on wheat, I'll get wheat. If I pour water on poisonous weeds, I get poisonous weeds. Water will accentuate the growth of whatever was there. But water does not convert weeds into grain. The Vilna Gaon says, Torah will take whatever is in you and intensify it, strengthen it, make it more. A person has mercy, compassion, kindness. Torah will make a person more compassionate, more kind, more giving. Well, that's unexceptional. But the Chiddush is the other point. If, God forbid, a person is arrogant, a person is proud, a person is selfish, this is a pretty amazing statement, the learning of the Torah might not only fail to improve him, it might make him worse, because it gives him another avenue to be arrogant, selfish, and self-righteous. Now, one cannot accuse, if this would be a Hasidic thought, one cannot accuse the Vilna Gaon of a bias against the intensive learning of Torah. The Vilna Gaon, above all people, was the person who was Osei in Torah Hashem 22 hours a day. The Vilna Gaon slept only 2 hours a day, and those 2 hours weren't even consecutive. He slept in 4 one-half-hour increments. The Vilna Gaon could calculate to the minute how many minutes a year he was not learning Torah, and when we say he was not learning Torah, he wasn't watching television, whatever it was. He said hello to somebody, whatever it would be. I mean, halvai that my learning of Torah should be whatever the Vilna Gaon called bittul Torah. So the Vilna Gaon was not somebody who was not machshiv the learning of Torah. So it's quite amazing that it's precisely the Vilna Gaon that says Torah will accentuate the bad midot that a person has. And therefore, the Vilna Gaon said, it is essential that in addition to your Torah study, you incorporate character development, mussar, working on midos, because it's not going to happen by itself. And this, by the way, was a big, big machlokas. This was a major, major machlokas. Rabbi Saul Salanter. Oh, by the way, so in that sense, let me just say, in that sense, you have to understand that the Vilna Gaon is actually considered to be the father of the mussar movement. What do I mean by that? Even in a direct sense, the Vilna Gaon's disciple, his greatest disciple, was Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Rav Chaim of Volozhin did start the world-famous Yeshiva of Volozhin, which was the mother of all the yeshivas in Poland and Lithuania. Slobodka, Mir, Kamenets, all of these came out of Volozhin. Volozhin was closed by the Russian government, a very fascinating story in which there's a lot of revisionism. Again, I could spend a long time about that. But the Volozhin yeshiva was called the Eim HaYeshivas. And Rav Chaim of Volozhin had many, many talmidim. But one of his talmidim was a tzaddik who did not have any position. He was a tzaddik that was very hidden, unknown. Rav Zundel, who's called Rav Zundel of Salant. Salant was a little shtetl near Vilna. And there was a young boy, Yisrael of Salant, who lived in Salant, who noticed this Rav Zundel. And nobody paid attention to Rav Zundel. He was a peddler, you know. He was not a Rosh Yeshiva. He did not give any shiurim. But Rav Yisrael Salanter, little Yisrael Salanter, saw something in Rav Zundel's behavior. And he used to follow him around. He used to spy on him. He wanted to see what Rav Zundel did, etc. And once Rav Zundel caught him in the act, because Rav Zundel would do all sorts of hidden mitzvahs, you know, he would take care of widows and orphans, and he would do all sorts of mitzvahs that nobody knew about. And then he would learn by himself where nobody saw him. And Rav Yisrael Salanter would spy on him, literally. He would just hang around and watch him in all of these different ways. And Rav Zundel caught him once and said to him, Yisrael, if you want to be a Yirei Shamayim, you must learn Mussar and apply Mussar. And that were the words. They say there were two Meisim that inspired Rabbi Saul Salanter to dedicate his life to character development. That's what Mussar is, character development. One was this encounter with Rav Zundel when he was a young boy. I think he was maybe 13 or 14. The other, they say, was, again, it's a famous Meisim. I don't know if it's true. A lot of the Meisim, we don't know if they're historically true. But they do represent the personalities. That he once saw a cobbler in Vilna. And it was getting dark. And the cobbler had to repair a shoe by the light of a candle. And it was very difficult. You're looking at the light. You didn't have electric lights then. You're looking at the light of a candle. You're sewing the shoe. And Rabbi Saul Salanter asked the person, isn't it so hard to sew? Why don't you stop working? So the cobbler said in Yiddish, as long as the candle burns, there's work to be done. And Rabbi Yisrael remembered that the Pasuk in Mishle says, the neshama of a person is a candle, ner Hashem, nishmas Adam. As long as the candle burns, you gotta do work. And that also is something that inspired him. And he took, but be it as it may, I want to point out, when Rabbi Yisrael Salanter developed a mussar program. Now, what do we mean by a mussar program? We don't mean today, you know, people learn mussar for 10 minutes in yeshiva. You know, the mussar program was not only about learning in books of mussar, which is true. In fact, there are three components in the mussar program. There is the intellectual component of learning the books of character development, which take Mamari Chazal and Gemaros and Midrashim, and you develop psychological insights and spiritual insights. That's an intellectual endeavor, just like any part of Torah, just like you can learn Hilchos Shabbos. You can learn the various laws and ideas that apply to Musar, right? So that is the Musar Be'ion. That is the intellectual development of Musar. But then there's a second component that is called Musar Behispalus. Musar Behispalut means Musar with emotional arousal. This was because Rabbi Sol Salanter recognized there is a big disconnect between our head and our hearts. And, you know, we may know a lot of things, but emotionally we don't feel the passion and connection to it. So this involved different techniques, meditation techniques. So Breslov aren't the only people who did this. Ideas of mantras in which you would take one Maimer Chazal, whatever, and you would just repeat it 100 or 1,000 times till it penetrated. That's why sometimes with the nigun, right, when people sing a nigun, they get impatient after, you know, after a minute they want to switch the nigun, but his palace says, no, stay with it, and it changes you. Musar b'his palace. So, for example, something like, whatever it would be like a disciple of Aaron, a lover, oev shalom, verodev shalom, say it 1,000 times, whatever it would be. That's Musar b'his palace. And the third idea of Musar, which is maybe the most important and the one that's least practiced today, is you might call a group therapy session for spiritual development. This is a Musar Vad, where people would meet together and they would discuss with each other, how can I be a better person? And indeed, there was a job in which you were supposed to point out the flaws of him and he was supposed to point out your flaws. And you would discuss things. That's a very difficult, very hard, very difficult. It's not just learning things theoretically. Now, Baruch Hashem, there are, in recent years, the Musar Vad has been revived, more with women than with men. So women are frankly in the forefront. But with men, there are Musar Vadim as well. Yep.
Was it the Chafetz Chaim introduced the Kanishka? That was a group doing the same thing to
improve character. That's right, but again, the Chafetz Chaim is after Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Right. The Chafetz Chaim is one of the, not a direct disciple, but he's one of the, that's correct. So the Musar Vad is very tough. You know, it's one thing to learn. I learn a book, I learn Masilut, I learn nice Sforim. It's another thing to talk about, to be honest, to confront myself, to look into my anger, look into my jealousy. That's very, very hard. In fact, they have a whole interesting thing about to acknowledge when you're fooling not just other people, but when you're fooling yourself. They say with Navardik, which was one of the great shittas of Musar, Navardik had many, many different interesting aspects of it, but one of them was you always had to be honest with yourself. So the story goes that two Navardikers were learning, and they had different opinions. One said the pshat is this, and one said the pshat is this. And finally, after arguing for an hour, the person said to the other person, you're right. So the Navardiker said, it's not enough to say I'm right. You have to say the words you're wrong. I'm wrong. You have to say I'm wrong. That's much harder. It's much harder to say I'm wrong than to say you're right. Because when I say you're right, you know, you're right, but I'm right too. You know, no, yeah. So the person said, what do you care? I said you're right. What are you bothering me? He says, no, you have to be moda al ha-emes. You have to say I am wrong. And those words are hard to say. We don't like to say those words. Now, why am I bringing this up? Because in a sense, it really parallels this debate. Because there were many Gedolim, people don't realize this, there were Gedolim who were against the introduction of Musar in the yeshiva curriculum. They said Musar might be good for balabatim, working people. We don't have to introduce it in the great yeshivas. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was against the introduction of Musar in Volozhin. And what was the argument? Now again, this doesn't mean the 10 minutes of learning Musar. I mean, Rav Chaim learned Musar too. But he was against kind of this whole major point of Vadim of Musar. It would take up hours a day sometimes. And Rav Chaim's position was, people who learn Torah, the Torah will purify their character. They don't need a structured Musar program because the Torah itself will do the job. That seems to be what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah seems to be saying here. Right? Rabban Gamliel says, no, you perfect your character first, then we'll teach you advanced Torah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah seems to say, the Torah will perfect your character. And yet, and there's a Yerushalmi that says that, the Yerushalmi says, it puts words in Hashem's mouth, that even if the Jewish people leave me, but they continue learning Torah, Hama'or Shaba, the light of the Torah, Machziro, Lamutav. And because of this, Rav Chaim was against Musar. In fact, there's a whole volume, the definitive history of all the Musar personalities is really a magnificent work called Tenuas HaMusar, the Musar movement. It's a 5-volume work by Rav Dov Katz. A volume and a half is Rav Yisrael Salanter, so he gets much more, but there are many, many personalities, some of which have a lot of pages, some of which have only a few pages. But he goes through all of the personalities, many, many stories, all of the stories, some of which are true, some of which are not, but all of the recorded stories. And he includes the Chafetz Chaim, who's kind of the last, really, of the official great Musar teachers, although Baruch Hashem, we have people after the Chafetz Chaim as well. But there was a 6th volume that he wrote that normally was not sold with the other 5. The 5 volumes were called Tenuas HaMusar. The 6th volume was called Pulmas HaMusar, the fights against Musar. The fights. And we're talking about cherims. Very, very, this was not always polite conversation. There were mashgichim who tried to introduce Musar in yeshivas who were beaten up and tarred and feathered and then thrown into the river. As is always the case, different gedolim have different views, but some of the disciples kind of go off the deep end in terms of how they enforce these different views. So he did this, he printed this volume for more of a private distribution because he didn't want to necessarily get into the Lashon Hara of all this. But I can say that in Yeshiva, when we became aware of this volume, we desperately hunted it down to get the, you know, get the true scoop on it and the like. But Chafetz Chaim's response to Rav Chaim's point was, Torah is the ideal food for a healthy person. When your neshama is healthy, and exactly what the Vilna Gaon says, like Torah and water. Torah is the food of a healthy person, and a healthy person maybe doesn't need medicine. But when you're sick, you have to augment your diet with medications. And when we have a sick soul, a soul that is filled with angers and resentments and egotism and selfishness, you need the Musar to take away some of that. And I just want to say, it seems, based on what I told you, that the Chafetz Chaim's view is rooted in the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Mishlei, which in turn, I think, influenced Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And I mentioned that even the Brisker Rav, Rav Chaim's own son, seemed to concede that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was right, and in fact that's why the Brisker Rav said it was Min HaShemayim that Volozhin was closed down to be replaced by the great yeshivos that did emphasize Musar. That was Slobodka, Kalem, Navardik, Amir, and the like. So where that leaves us is a bit of confusion. We seem to have multiple voices and multiple views on this critical issue. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took the position, and Rav Kook seems to endorse that position. So I don't know what Rav Kook's view was on direct Musar start, that Torah itself refines your character. And therefore, let the person come in. The Torah will change him. On the other hand, we have Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the view of the Vilna Gaon that says there has to be direct working on Midos Tovos. So really, I mean, ultimately, maybe we don't have a final psak. Maybe it just depends on how sick the person is, how sick we might be in any given case. We might be sick to such an extreme measure that we need more concentration on Midos, or in some cases, if we're not so sick, the Torah itself can carry us. But this was all I'm pointing out, without giving you a psak halacha on this, we do see the different views about Torah and character. Do you need character to absorb the Torah? Or do I say the Torah itself elevates your character and purifies it. Okay. Now, another thing the Chafetz Chaim said, Rav Chafetz Chaim said, any yeshiva that did not emphasize Musar and Midos Tovos is equivalent to what is called a Bor Birshus Harabim. Now, I don't know if everyone's familiar with this. A Bor Birshus Harabim simply means, it's a din in the Torah, that if I dig a pit in a public road and somebody falls into the pit and gets hurt, I'm obligated to pay their damages because I created obstacles that are dangerous to the public. The Chafetz Chaim said, to produce rabbis, teachers, and talmidei chachamim who don't have midos tovos, you are essentially creating a public hazard. You are creating a bor b'shus harabim. And you're creating a bor b'shus harabim in two different ways, I would suggest. I mean, what is the danger of rabbis, talmidei chachamim? I won't say gedolim, because by definition they could not be a gadol, but without midos tovos. But what is the danger? So the danger is twofold. Number one, those who listen to them will be led astray because they will also be acting out of anger and hate. But number two, those who don't listen to them are going to lose their respect for Talmidei Chachamim and for Torah, and therefore they're going to wander away from them. So the danger is twofold. It's a danger for the people who follow them, and it's a danger for the people who don't follow them, because then they're going to say, oh, the Torah is worthless, the Torah is no good, because Torah leaders are people of mean and despicable and selfish character. So the Chafetz Chaim says, without Musar, you have created a yeshiva that sends such people into the world, has created a bor birshus harabim. Right? This is what the Chafetz Chaim said. And I came across just the other day a very excellent old article by Rabbi Wein on the dangers of charismatic leadership. Sometimes people gravitate to charisma, which is flashy and the like. But in charisma, there also might be arrogance and gaiva. And he says what we need to look for sometimes in a leader. I mean, Rabbi Wein didn't mention this part, but I would add. The Drasha Saran says, why was Moshe Rabbeinu a kvad peh, kvad lashon? Moshe Rabbeinu was not a good speaker. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't talk, basically. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Jewish people to be influenced, not by charisma or flash, but by the deep content and truth of the words. So Hashem wanted to remove all the externalities of the messenger, so the only thing that counted was the message. The leader, the great leader of the Jewish people, was a decidedly uncharismatic figure. Couldn't talk, couldn't communicate very well, etc. Now, I'm not saying Badafka hire a person who doesn't speak well. I'm not saying Badafka look for that. But sometimes the qualities that are most important are devalued in a process. What you should be looking for are midos, gentleness, modesty, humility, acceptance of people, as well as, of course, Torah knowledge, Yirat Shamayim, those things are a given. And the qualities of arrogance are something that are mamish, very, very destructive. And fakert, as the Vilna Gaon tells us, the learning of a person might accentuate those negative attributes because they give the person another avenue to be arrogant. So be it as it may, once again, we sometimes don't have definitive answers here. But we do see two educational philosophies. Now, Rav Kook points out, he brings in a very interesting passage of the Rambam, which is very nogeya lahalacha in a totally different context. There's a famous Rambam. You know, we have, to a greater or lesser degree, a serious problem called the Aguna crisis. Man, Aguna simply means a woman whose husband is refusing to give her a get. In the United States, even after civil divorce, in Israel, there is no civil divorce, so if there's no get, she's not divorced. And women are sometimes held agunot for a number of years. And there's a recent decision around a year ago now, based in the spot that where a man was in a coma, and they created some mechanism for her to get a get. Again, this is a share for another time. But at a time when there was a beis din, and actually, in Eretz Yisrael, this can still be done for a certain degree. And that is, if a beis din orders a man to give a get, a man can be beaten until he says, Rotze Ani. Now in America, unless you hire goons informally, there's no way that can be done. It can be done illegally. And in fact, some rabbis are under federal prosecution for doing that in America. But in Eretz Yisrael, there is, they're not beaten, but under the law of the Knesset, if a Beit Din orders a man to give yad, he can go to jail. He can lose his passport. He can have his driver's license suspended. He can be fined. So there is this concept that a man can be forced to give a get. Now the Rambam raises a question. Well, wait a second here. On one hand, there is a rule that says any person that is forced to give a get, it's not a valid get. But then you have a rule, you can beat a guy over the head till he says, I want. But how can that be good? He was forced. So here is what the Rambam answers. The Rambam says, every single Jewish person in his heart of hearts wants to keep the Torah. That is his true desire. But what happens is the Yetzer Hara, his selfishness, his stinginess, sometimes gets the better of him. So when I put a gun to his head and I say, give a get or I'll shoot, that kind of takes away the Yetzer Hara not to give a get. But the yes that comes out is not a yes that is coerced. It is the true yes. Now, because of this, now this is not just semantics, I want to point out, that is why it's important, this is very important, that this can only be done if a Beis Din ordered him to give a get. If a woman were to hire the goons before the psak of a Beis Din, the get would be puzzled, because you cannot yet say he truly wants to give the get, because maybe he doesn't, because maybe he's not obligated to give a get. You understand? In other words, but this is a rule. Once, halakhically, he is obligated to give a get, coercion can be employed because it represents the true personality of a person. So Rav Kook says that is really part of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's point. That, well, on one hand we're saying he's good on the outside, bad on the inside. Don't let him in. But Rav Kook said, no Jew is really bad on the inside. Because there's the outside of the inside and there's the inside of the inside. Maybe he's bad on the outside of the inside, but the inside of the inside is in fact good. And therefore, if you put him in the environments where people are doing good things, that's going to make him good also. Not going to make him good, it's going to connect his inside of the inside with his outside of the outside. Remember, the outside of the outside is good, and the inside of the inside is good. The problem is that the outside of the inside isn't good, but you connect the inner with the outer, right? And he brings the Rambam in for that particular idea. And in fact, the Balatanya, if I could juxtapose the Balatanya writes that love of Hashem and fear of Hashem, reverence of Hashem, are not qualities that we have to learn. They are qualities that Hashem put into our neshamas. It's already there. We're sometimes not connected to it. All we have to do, it's not easy, but all we have to do is open up what is already in us. And then we will be connected. And that, Rav Kook says, was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Take the Jew, expose them to Torah. Torah will open them up. Torah will change them. Torah will transform them. But as I say, we still have that pedagogical issue of the grub, that when there are actual bad midos, you have to deal with the bad midos specifically. You can't just generically do it with Torah. It's interesting, you know, I once said over, just to give you an example of how this idea can be so foreign to people, I once said over this thought that Torah can actually make bad midos worse. And I said it, maybe I said it in the wrong city. I was in Lakewood. I said it in Lakewood. And a person just told me, I don't believe it says that anywhere. I don't believe it's true. And I can give you chapter and verse. It's the Vilna Gaon in Perek Yud Tes of Mishlei. I don't remember the exact passage, but I have the exact passage. And it's there. It is there. It is not simply a thought that I made up. And once again, coming from the Vilna Gaon, I think, gives it much more credibility than almost anyone else. Number one, because of the Vilna Gaon. But number two, the Vilna Gaon, Vedavka, is the person who was machshiv every single second of learning of Torah. So he, God forbid, he was not someone who didn't respect intensive Torah learning. So just I'm saying this is an idea that's so foreign to us. I once saw a Purim play about shiduchim in the firm world, and it had a video of a rabbi who was talking to a family and saying, yes, he wears a borsalino, yes, his sisters are this, he does not wear tchelis, because tchelis means you're a little odd, etc. And then at the end, he gets the question, what about his midos? So the rabbi looks very perplexed. Midos. You know, nobody ever asked me that. And that's kind of the priorities that we have, at least in Baruch Hashem. The fact that it was satirized in a play means that, you know, we are aware that that's something we need to be thinking about. Yeah. Well, the simplest example is arrogance. Let's say a person is conceited. A person thinks he's better than other people. A person looks down at other people. As he learns more and more and more, he may have a sense of pride in himself. You know, I'm so much better than these people. They don't understand this. They don't understand that. They're amaratzim. They're ignorant. In fact, this was actually a problem, in particular in the United States. I can even identify this with you. You know, widespread yeshiva learning, Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem is getting more and more in America. And often you have yeshiva students whose parents did not go to yeshiva. Either the parents are Bali Tshuva, or even if the parents were Orthodox, they grew up at a time when it was not so makubal to go to yeshivas. Right? Whatever, there was a time in which it was not always the norm. And you sometimes have a situation where the kids don't respect their parents' sacrifices. They certainly don't respect the synagogue rabbi. You know, he's kind of a prostitute because he became modern Orthodox rabbi somewhere. And the very rabbi that was, I'm not talking about, this is not autobiographical, I'm just referring to just a phenomenon that I've seen over the year. The very rabbi that made these kids religious is now somebody who's looked down as, you know, an Amoritz or whatever it is. So it is very much the case that unless there is Musar and the like, it is possible. I'm not saying it always happens. Baruch Hashem there. And again, I the last thing that any of us should be is holier than thou, because that is arrogance also. And of course, there are many B'nai Torah, many B'nos Torah, that are humble, that are modest, that are wonderful, that are righteous. Of course. Chas v'shalom, I cannot impugn a whole class of people. But as a phenomenon that can exist, there can indeed be arrogance within the learning of Torah, because a person thinks he's better than other people. And that's not a proper attitude, that's all. So that would be one example.
I think that person really learned Torah properly. He's more arrogant because he's more knowledgeable in Torah. Very, very wrong.
That's correct. Well, that's correct. Ultimately, that's really the Vilna Gaon's point, that you need to work on your midos, and then the Torah will permeate you. You know, the old story, I'll end here, if you saw Salanter, another famous mimer, somebody was once suggesting a chassan for somebody, and they said, this chassan has gone through Shas 2 times. A good accomplishment. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, how many times has Shas gone through him? Right? So there is that thing. You can go through something. Has it really gone through you in a proper way? And that's really a more important question. But again, as I say, we shouldn't walk out of here characterizing anyone as a class. You know, we're not here to say everybody's as everybody's that. If anything, like always, the musr that we take is a musr for us to take, you know, in terms of what is important for us, how we raise our families, what we look for in shiduchim with our children, and ultimately what we look for in our rabbanim and our spiritual leaders and like, right? So these are just ideas that we should think about in terms of how we live our lives. Okay, we'll continue next week and have a good week.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you remember?